At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Roller coaster, choppy ocean, pendulum, wild ride. Anybody else running out of silly metaphors for this stock market? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity, online at us.areva.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing, constantcontact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It is the 11th day of September. Wall Street paused to remember the events of this day 7 years ago. At the New York Stock Exchange, traders observed a moment of silence before the opening bell. The Nasdaq suspended trades between 10:29 and 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. But for the rest of the trading day, all eyes were once again on Lehman Brothers. It lost another 40% off its share price, finishing at $4.22. The Wall Street Journal reports the brokerage giant is in talks to sell itself, possibly to Bank of America. The Treasury Department says it is monitoring the situation. As it has all week, Lehman took much of the banking sector down with it, most notably Washington Mutual. The nation's largest savings and loan dipped briefly below $2 a share before settling at $2.83. It's lost 40% in the last 2 days. Wachovia is also on the Better Watch It list. So what's next? Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
Investment banks and brokerage firms aren't the only ones up to their necks in bad mortgage assets.
The uncertainty of getting a home loan made Paul irritable. Then he went to Washington Mutual. Thanks to their flexible lending rules, Paul got a quick approval.
Maybe too quick. WAMU now says it expects to lose about $19 billion because of bad home loans. Lawrence White is with NYU's Stern School of Business. He says banks are in the same boat as Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Lehman Brothers. They own lots of mortgage-related assets, which are now practically worthless.
These are major assets on the balance sheets of commercial banks, savings institutions, investment banks. This has real consequences.
About a dozen banks have failed so far this year, and financial institutions have written off about $500 billion. All told, we're in the middle of the biggest banking downturn in 2 decades, and investors don't think we've seen the end. The Milken Institute's James Barth says things won't turn around until the housing market starts to recover, and investors gain confidence that the rash of write-downs is over.
Mortgage markets have to somehow stabilize. Prices have to stop falling, and banks have to basically be in a position to raise additional capital, which is difficult to do these days.
Barth says that may be difficult as long as foreclosures continue to rise. He says the credit crunch could begin to ease next year, but in the meantime, we're likely to see more banks descend into even deeper trouble. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Believe it or not, Lehman's problems don't end with a 90% drop in share price. The tax man may soon be knocking at the door. The company is one of several investment banks accused in a congressional report of helping foreign clients evade millions of dollars in U.S. taxes. But it turns out these transactions have been around for years. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story from New York.
The report says major financial institutions are profiting from this tax avoidance. It cites data from Morgan Stanley, which shows these schemes allowed customers, including offshore hedge funds, to avoid $300 million in taxes between 2000 and 2007. Democratic Senator Carl Levin chaired this morning's hearing. He says he doesn't oppose the transactions per se.
What I oppose is the misuse of financial transactions to undermine the tax code, rob the U.S. Treasury, and force honest Americans to shoulder the country's tax burden.
Here's how it works. Right before, say, an offshore hedge fund is due to pay a 30% tax on dividends, it transfers its investments to a U.S.-based institution. It pays that firm a fee to hold the investments. A few days later, the hedge fund takes the shares back and avoids the tax man. All the banks say this is completely legal. Here's Lehman's John DeRosa.
Lehman has worked diligently to follow the letter and spirit of the law governing both equity swaps and stock loan agreements.
Charles Elson, director of the Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware, says that may be, but
there have been a lot of folks who've marketed tax avoidance schemes that have turned out to be tax evasive and determined to be illegal. And what we're going to have to look at is, in fact, what was being done here. Was this lawful avoidance or was it unlawful evasion?
Just looking into that question could be new ground for the government. The report says both the IRS and the Treasury Department have failed to clarify the rules or enforce abuses. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
We've been hearing a lot about negative ads over the last few months, ads stirring up the culture wars in this country, turning elite into a four-letter word. A new spate is about to come out, but not from the usual suspects. Here's Rico Galliano.
The ads are airing as local markets roll out McDonald's new McCafe premium drinks. The spots are set in Starbucks-esque coffee shops. One features two hipster dudes, the other two stylish urban women.
You know, I heard McDonald's is making lattes now.
McDonald's? Well, that's just... it's fantastic.
Now we don't have to listen to jazz all day long.
I can start wearing heels again.
We dust.
Barbara Lippert is a critic for Adweek Media. She says competitors have poked fun at Starbucks before, but these new ads take things a step further to culture war in the coffee house.
It really seems to be in the Sarah Palin moment, because all of that is about anti-intellectualism and shooting and hunting. And this is, you know, oh, we really always hated Starbucks, and thank God for McDonald's and a real American option.
Now, the ads were surely in development long before Sarah Palin hit the scene. And in a statement, McDonald's says it's simply trying to bring in, quote, customers who may not be visiting us today for premium coffee. Still, more than one ad expert makes the connection between the presidential and the McDonald's campaigns.
It's adapting kind of the campaign approach.
Faith Popcorn is CEO of marketing consultants Brain Reserve.
I can't imagine that anybody could fall for this.
And yet, time after time, we've seen that people do fall for negative campaigns, you know.
But this is beyond a negative campaign. This is condescending to say that they're not smart enough to go to Starbucks.
See you at the polls. I mean, coffee shop. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, that news of a possible buyout of Lehman, topped off by falling oil prices, propelled a last-minute rally. We'll have details when we do the numbers. With the jobless rate up over 6%, more people are receiving unemployment benefits, and more people are staying on unemployment. Today, the Labor Department reported more than 3.5 million people continued to receive benefits in the last week of August, and that means states are struggling to pay the bill. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
In a healthy economy, there's about one unemployed person for each job opening. In today's economy, there are 2.5 unemployed people per job opening.
You have this very unforgiving game of musical chairs going on right now, where the number of jobless people is increasing, but the number of job openings is declining.
That's Jared Bernstein with the Economic Policy Institute.
We're just not creating the kind of dynamic opportunities that folks need to get off those roles and back into the job market.
States are responsible for paying unemployment benefits, and they're having trouble keeping up. Andrew Stettner is with the National Employment Law Project.
We found that about 18 states were either near insolvency or insolvent.
New York and Michigan have had to borrow from the federal government this year to pay claims.
It's worse than it's been for the last 20 years since the the early 80s recession.
Carol Montana worked at the Times Herald Record newspaper in Middletown, New York, until she was laid off last year. After 18 months of off and on benefits, she still hasn't found another job.
I didn't think I'd be one of those millions of people who are out of work and collecting unemployment. It's a scary club to be in at this point in time.
A club that's likely to grow in membership in the coming months. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Wall Street was badly wounded when the World Trade Center was destroyed 7 years ago. Between the terrorist attacks and the recession that was already underway at the time, the securities industry lost thousands of jobs. Those jobs had only just recovered to pre-9/11 levels when the credit crunch hit about a year ago. Marketplace's Amy Scott went to Lower Manhattan to see how the latest downturn is affecting the rebuilding effort.
I'm standing here with Ted Weisberg of Seaport Securities. Ted, how long have you been at the New York Stock Exchange?
Almost 40 years. I'm embarrassed to say 40 years of doing the same thing, being a floor trader.
As Weisberg and I walk along Broad Street past the New York Stock Exchange, one change since 9/11 is impossible to ignore. The streets are closed to cars. Police officers armed with automatic rifles survey the scene. Construction crews are busy building a series of traffic blockades.
I think the only people that are making money in Wall Street these days are the contractors and the construction people.
The Wall Street bonus pool has shrunk in the last year. Thousands have lost their jobs. But Lower Manhattan is cashing in on a stream of foreign tourists drawn here by the weaker dollar. Developers have converted dozens of office buildings into luxury condos. And spendy brands like Hermes, Tiffany, and BMW have all set up shop to cater to the new clientele.
All these stores are new, and all since 9/11. And it just is indicative of how the whole nature of the Wall Street area, the whole demographics, if you will, of who comes here has changed so dramatically.
The business culture has changed, too. The financial epicenter has spread to Midtown Manhattan, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Media and high-tech firms have moved in. Brad Gerla works with real estate firm C.B. Richard Ellis in Lower Manhattan. He says the new economic diversity is shielding the district from Wall Street's woes and creating a vibrant scene.
Downtown never used to have that 24-hour, 7-day-a-week community. You know, after 5, 6 o'clock, it was pretty dark down here. You come down here now at 6 o'clock, and the streets are very active. There are bars, there are restaurants, and I don't see anything that's going to stop that.
There is one dark cloud over Lower Manhattan's revival. At a Ground Zero memorial service yesterday, a singer competed with the din of construction equipment. Infighting and delays have plagued the rebuilding here. Robert Sammons is head of research at real estate firm Colliers ABR. He says the delays are frustrating current tenants and discouraging new ones.
You're basically sitting next to a huge construction site, and all that means. So it's a problem, and it could become an even greater problem if it drags out very long. Because
Sammons says it could be another 5 years or more before the 1,700-foot Freedom Tower opens its doors. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, exporters feel the squeeze at the port.
There's no additional capacity from North America, U.S., Canada, East Coast, Gulf Coast, or West Coast. The ships are full.
But first, let's do the numbers. Energy shares helped Wall Street shrug off the Lehman blues today. The Dow pushed up 1.4%, 164 points to close at 11,433. The Nasdaq jumped 1.3%, 29 points to finish at 2258. The S&P climbed 0.9%, 11 points to end the day at 1243. The price of a barrel of oil sloshed down nearly $2 to just above $100 today. That sent energy companies higher. Refiner Sunoco pumped up more than 12%. Tesoro Petroleum spouted 9%. And Valero Energy bubbled up 6.75%. Financials got a spanking, though. Lehman lurched 41% lower. Merrill Lynch gave back 16%. And Wachovia wobbled 5%. Washington Mutual's share slumped below $2 at the open, but clawed back nearly 22% over the day. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.63%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, working to redefine healthcare and the patient experience with the new Miller Family Pavilion and Glickman Tower. More at meetthebuildings.com. And by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for August. The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for August. And the National Private Truck Council concludes its annual safety conference in Herndon, Virginia. According to organizers, private fleets make up the largest part of the trucking industry. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Don't know about you, but when I retire from public radio, I'm going to stay that way. No unretiring to get back behind the microphone. At least that's the plan. Of course, that was also the plan for Lance Armstrong. Only in his case, he's about getting back on the bike. This week, Armstrong confirmed that 3 years after announcing his retirement, he's in training for next year's Tour de France, and he is far from the only athlete unretiring this year. Brett Favre was barely retired 3 months before engineering his own reverse play. Here with some thoughts is our Business of Sports commentator, Diana Nyad. And let me ask you, you want to make any unretirement announcements yourself here?
Oh, no. You couldn't pay me to swim another lap.
But everybody's doing it.
They are. But you know what it is, Tess? You said, okay, you know, once you retire, you're not coming back. But how old will you be when you retire? It's the tragedy, shall we say, of sports, that you have to give it up when you're young. If you're done when you're 28, 35 years old, it's only human nature that a couple months later, a couple years later, you think, wait a second, I still feel pretty good. You know, I bet I could get out there and beat these guys again.
But is this about money at all? Do these people not have enough of it, or are they just bored?
Brett Favre, come on, he doesn't need another penny. He could have easily said, don't pay me this year. I just want to come back and write my own ticket where I
want to
play.
I don't think that's what he said, though.
He never did say that, but and his wife never did say that. But Lance Armstrong has gone so far as to say that he will not take prize money. Of course, all he's talking about is the exact direct prize money. Now, any endorsements that he comes
he's
by.
He's not going to turn those down.
The bank account will be wide open and welcoming.
Well, what is their value when they return? Is it any different from before they retired?
It's even bigger. I mean, the number 4 Favre jersey is selling through the roof.
As a jet.
I was just in New York over Labor Day weekend, and, you know, every bus, every subway stop has, you know, Brett, 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 he's a jet, jet, jet. The guy's sales value has gone through the roof, bigger than ever. And Lance's will be right up there also. The trouble will be, what if he's not as good?
That is the question. And I'm sure that's a question that, for example, networks that carry the Tour de France might ask.
Before Lance, the ratings for the Outdoor Life Network, which is now Versus, but that's what it was called then, were about 100,000 people a day. When he was in his prime, there were about 500,000 people a day, which still isn't big for, you know, baseball, football.
But that's a pretty big increase.
It's a big climb. Now, the last couple of years when he hasn't been there, they've gone to half that. My suspicion is they'll be right back up, maybe even more so, because all those people who now have read his books know his cancer story, you know, more so than before. They'll tune in just to see this guy. Can he do it at this age? What's he look like? Does he look beat and tired?
What about all the races that kind of sprang up around the story of Lance Armstrong? How have those done, and what
could his return do for that?
There weren't big races in the United States, not really. But once Lance became the king of the sport with his huge personal story, you know, the Amgen Tour of California, the Tour of Georgia, or they call it the Tour de Georgia, and, you know, the Tour of Missouri.
They're so French down there.
They're so Francais. There's some pretty popular U.S. races that all sort of burgeoned during Lance's reign. And when he quit, their sponsorship just sort of evaporated overnight. So now my suspicion is, because Lance said he's going to ride those two, the money will roll in again, at least while he's out there on the road.
Our business of sports commentator, Diana Nyad. You sure you're not making a comeback?
You going to sponsor me?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I'll start this afternoon. Okay. I'm going to swim around the world, and I should be done, about 2015. So I hope you're still with us.
That's that one time. Heck of an unretirement. Thanks so much.
Okay, Tess.
Today, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev unveiled a plan to restore confidence in his country's economy. The Russian stock market has lost 40% of its value since May. Medvedev wants to make the Russian market a lot more transparent and give foreigners easier access to it. Commentator Dan Dresner says economic modernization is a good buffer against war. Question is, for how long?
In The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Thomas Friedman proposed the Golden Arches theory of conflict prevention. Friedman wrote, "No two countries that both had McDonald's had fought a war against each other since each got its McDonald's." This was shorthand for saying that economic globalization reduced the likelihood of armed conflict. Alas, the war between Russia and Georgia flatly contradicts Friedman's hypothesis. Furthermore, Russia has continued to act in a confrontational fashion. Moscow formally recognized the breakaway republics of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. President Dmitry Medvedev articulated a new, aggressive foreign policy doctrine within Russia's sphere of influence. And there are a surprising number of McDonald's franchises in the Russian periphery. These events have led a lot of geostrategists to say that the rules of the global game have changed. A century ago, Norman Angel proclaimed that no country would be stupid enough to think it could profit more from war than trade. A few years later, World War I broke out. Will Friedman become the Angel of this century? Let's not throw the baby out with the Big Mac. In international relations, no country is perfect. Even if one McGlobalized country attacks another McGlobalized country, globalization still reduces the chance for war. In important ways, the theory is working quite well. Even without economic sanctions, Russia is paying a price for its actions. Last week, Russia's RTS index dropped 7% and has fallen by 33% since July. Last month, $20 billion left Russian markets in search for safer havens. Moscow has had to intervene aggressively in foreign exchange markets to defend the ruble. In the end, the war has resulted in losers on all sides. Through its aggressive behavior, Georgia has lost its breakaway provinces. While Russia has humiliated Georgia, every country in the region is now balancing against Moscow. Angel and Friedman are right to say that economic interdependence makes war very costly. The 64,000 ruble question is whether Russia is willing to pay that price over and over again.
Dan Dresner teaches international politics at Tufts University. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. The country's trade deficit soared in July, touching its highest level in 16 months, just over $62 billion. The bright spot, though, exports. They're up 3.3% over last year. Agricultural products are one reason, but here's the thing that's driving American farmers batty. They could export even more, if not for a bottleneck on the shipping front. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from the farmland of Eastern Maryland.
For a fresh perspective on the global economy, here's how it looks through the eyes of a chicken. Life begins at a corporate hatchery, followed by 7 weeks of feeding on corn and soybean meal. Then Joe or Jane Chicken gets slaughtered. Its white meat sells in the U.S. Dark meat goes to Eastern Europe, and the fat sells to soap makers. Chicken feet export to China.
Here in the U.S., not a lot of people like them. I do, but that's not very popular here.
Carlos Ayala is vice president with Purdue Chicken in Eastern Maryland.
So we export them over to China, and they love them. They'll pay close to double the price for a chicken foot that they will for boneless breast meat.
China imports more than 1.2 billion chicken feet every month. That's enough for one claw per person. They're stewed, pickled, fried, breaded. But here's the catch. Ayala can't find enough shipping containers to send them over.
It used to be a lot like a utility. If you pick up the phone, you expect to hear a dial tone. Flip a light switch and the light turns on. We order a container, we'd get containers. That has changed.
What has changed is the number of containers coming into U.S. ports. 3 hours south in Norfolk, Virginia, ships still come and go, but they're smaller than just a couple years ago, since struggling American consumers are buying less. Smaller ships mean fewer containers. So when these vessels return to Asia, there's less space for American exporters. Peter Friedman is executive director of the Agriculture Transportation Coalition.
There's no additional capacity from North America, U.S., Canada, East Coast, Gulf Coast, or West Coast. The ships are full.
So these days, bags and bags of Purdue chicken get forklifted into a port freezer facility, where they wait, like airline passengers on standby. Now, this problem ruffles feathers for all exporters. Cotton farmers in the South, almond growers in California, and grain producers in the Midwest. To be clear, the sky is not falling. U.S. agriculture exports rose 45% over last year, thanks to a weak dollar and healthy demand from Asia. But Friedman thinks his members could export 20% more if not for the shipping bottleneck. And when some orders take too long to get there,
you lose the customer. Customer says, I need it fresh, I need it now, I've got to put it on market, I've run big advertisements here in Japan, I'm expecting it. And if you don't deliver, I'm going to have to find a substitute. And if we cannot be a dependable source, they will go somewhere else.
Somewhere else, like Turkey or Brazil. Frustrated American farmers blame the shipping carriers for cutting back on their slow boats to China. But to economist Paul Bingham, this is just business. He's with the forecasting firm Global Insight.
And many of these companies truly are global, and they've got options. They don't need to just serve the U.S. market. They've got business that has nothing to do with the United States.
In fact, carriers make more money sailing within Asia, or between Asia and the Middle East. Perhaps that reflects a new balance in the world economy. And if things stay that way, U.S. exporters like Purdue will keep counting their chickens they're not selling. In Salisbury, Maryland, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, you've heard the term blood diamond? Well, get ready for blood oil. Today, the president of Nigeria asked oil experts to research whether a chemical marker could be added to crude oil. The idea is that foreign markets could then test their oil imports to make sure they were legally extracted. Criminals and militants in Nigeria have taken to siphoning oil from pipelines and other facilities and reselling it. Officials there say as much as 10% of Nigeria's daily supply is stolen and sold off illegally. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 164 points, 1.4%. The Nasdaq added 29 points, 1.3%. And the S&P 500 gained 11 points, 0.9%. Kevin Artovitz, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, detecting fine wine fraud with a picture-perfect device.
Kodak requires that we keep it in a safe. Only myself and my winemaker have access to it. But I can't tell you too much about it or I'd have to kill you.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.